Good evening, and welcome to another Fireside Chat. This is your host, Zany Mystic. I have a real special treat tonight because my guest is actually somebody that I've known for almost 7 years. She and I do pro bono healing work with a small group of friends that are scattered around the globe. And so I know this lady pretty well. I've never spoken with her before, but she's a wonderful soul. And she's been working for a couple of decades as a combining music and healing. She has her doctorate, I believe, in musicology, and she does many, many other things. And instead of me telling you, I'm just going to go ahead and welcome our guest tonight, who is Dr. Alice Cash. Hello, Alice.
Hello, Lance. How are you?
Good. We've never spoken on the phone before, have we?
No, I don't guess we have.
Well, that's all right. It's about time. Everything comes full circle, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, it's really great to actually begin to talk to you because, you know, we've been doing healing work with this group for a while, and I really don't have a lot of formal training. You and most of the other healers on the group have quite a bit of training and do this professionally. And I'm really interested in learning more about, you know, what is music, healing with music and music therapy, and what do you do?
Okay. Well, I mean, we can go in a lot of different directions with that, but just to start out with, and then I'll let you stop me and focus it in various areas if you
okay.
like.
Sure.
But healing with music is one of the most ancient ways of healing that is out there, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And I think actually the original music in this lifetime, well, not even in our lifetime, in the lifetime of the planet Earth, was the music of nature.
Yeah.
And the music of the wind and the trees and the waves on the shore and crickets chirping, bird
yeah.
songs, all of that was probably the original music. And people were aware that it was pleasant and pleasurable in most cases. And when they decided to try to create their own music,
mm-hmm.
they were imitating the sounds of nature that they had heard.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have records that would be like drawings on cave walls from ancient times showing people beating on drums and shaking rattles and dancing around perhaps a bed of leaves or straw or branches where a sick person would be lying, and indications that people were singing and toning probably and trying to get evil spirits, which they thought caused the illness. You know,
mm-hmm.
Illness was totally a mystery. Nobody knew why people suddenly fell ill.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would build to a giant crescendo, and at the peak of that, they believed that the evil spirit would be released or driven out.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would start the more soothing, calming, melodious singing, we think, which would be to entreat the good spirits to come back and restore a person to health.
Mm. Well, that sure makes a lot of sense to me. How did you get started in this work?
Well, I think the beginning of it was the fact that I was born into a family in which my father was a Methodist minister.
Uh-huh.
And I saw him working with people on a regular basis, doing counseling.
Oh.
I saw people go into his office, you know, upset and tearful, and come out not with everything, you know, perfectly hunky-dory, but
right.
clearly feeling a lot better and being so grateful to him. And I remember thinking, I would love to be able to help people like my father does. And so for the first 25 years of my life, I was exclusively a musician, and
mm-hmm.
I mainly was entertaining people, I would say.
Mm.
And then I transitioned into being a music professor, a college music professor.
Mm.
And it wasn't until after I got my PhD, when I was about 40, I think, that suddenly this job came into my realm of awareness that was working in a music and medicine program at the University of Louisville School of Medicine. And they hired me as coordinator of music and medicine primarily to do scientific research on the healing properties of music.
Oh, wow.
Had a very, very amazing, insightful 75-year-old psychiatrist running the program.
Wow.
And he said, you know, Alice, we have centuries of anecdotal reports about music's healing power and toning and chanting and drumming, but we have very little empirical evidence that tells us exactly what music does to the mind and the body that causes all these wonderful reports. And so we decided, you know, you can't just tell people to take two Mozart sonatas and call you in the morning.
That's very good.
Even though Mozart is supposed to be very healing.
Right.
But scientists and modern-day physicians want numbers.
Right.
And exactly how much music delivered in exactly what method is going to result in how much healing.
And some predictability in that.
Right,
too.
Right. So they realized, of course, that I did not have a clinical degree at that point. And they said, we would like to send you and pay for you to get a clinical degree.
Wow.
And I didn't really want to be a nurse, and I felt like it was a little too late to be a doctor. So I said, how about a clinical social worker? So most of my clinical training was more in psychological and social kind of issues. Depression, anxiety, addictions.
Yes, addictions. That's one that's familiar to me.
Yes, to me too, and many in my family and in my realm. And, you know, I think it's really a spiritual path.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And when you mentioned about your dad, you know, something struck me about that, that really isn't the essence of all healing a spiritual healing, wouldn't you? I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, I would say so, absolutely, because we know now, you know, how powerful the mind is in any sort of disease or healing process. And I think when people tune into a more spiritual connection, they become more open to healing, and that spiritual connection is what really makes it possible, I think.
So, tell me what some of your findings were when you actually started to do, scientific research. What kind of do you have something for the people out there with a more of an intellectual and scientific bent? To prove that music actually does have some kind of beneficial effect, if not...
Yes, I do.
Oh, good.
I do. the first study, I mean, basically, this psychiatrist who was named Dr. Joel Elkies, and he's fairly well known in the field of what he calls attitudinal medicine. He pretty much knew what he wanted me to study. So the first study that we did was called Psychophysiological Benefits of Chant.
Ooh.
And we took a group of local Buddhist chanters.
Ooh.
That do the Nam-myoho Renge-kyo.
Oh, yes.
And the connection was our local orchestra, the Louisville Orchestra. The conductor's wife was a devout Buddhist and had been doing this chanting for 20 years. So she was able to talk about 20 of the local Buddhist chanters to participate in our study. And what we did was to attach biofeedback electrodes to them, to measure breathing, skin temperature, heart rate, the perspiration on the palms, and skin temperature. And so we attached these electrodes. We got a five-minute baseline, just them sitting. Then we had them chant for 30 minutes. And there was a computer that was showing everything that was going on with these five physiological parameters. And then we had a five-minute baseline, and then we had them read aloud from a book they had never seen before just to compare two different kinds of vocalizations. And so the kinds of things we found were that when the people started, because they were not used to chanting, you know, hooked up to equipment and a lot of other people who were sort of had them under a microscope, so to speak, many of them had rapid pulse, sweaty palms, icy palms because, you know, their hands were cold and clammy. And as they began chanting the Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, The skin warmed up, their hands warmed up, in one lady as much as 20 degrees.
Oh, my goodness.
And the heart rate became slower and steady, where it was sort of rapid and, you know, maybe even a little irregular. So all of these physiological parameters moved toward a calm, relaxed state within 10 minutes of chanting, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they stopped and went to reading out of a book they had never seen before, all of the anxiety symptoms more or less recurred. Mm-hmm. The hands got cold and clammy again, and their heart rate was, you know, fast for a while and slow and then fast. And so what we decided was that people have reported for thousands of years that chanting makes them calm.
Mm-hmm.
It helps them to be more focused, more insightful, and it does literally put them temporarily into an altered state.
Mm.
And it's a way of doing that without any kind of chemicals whatsoever.
Mm.
So the chanting moves people more toward homeostasis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they're really hot, they get cool and calm. If they're really cold and sweaty, then they warm up and calm down. And it was clear. I mean, we could just watch this computer screen, all of those lines just smooth out right in the normal range.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty cool.
Wow. Well, that sounds awesome.
And then the second study we did was I believe it was the psychophysiological benefits of music with Alzheimer's patients.
Oh.
Because Dr. Elke said, Alice, these are my peers.
Oh,
and,
yes.
You know, just in case it ever happens to me or any of my family, I want to know as much about things you can do to help as possible.
Wow.
So what we discovered there, we went to a nursing home that had a state-of-the-art Alzheimer's unit and lots of family interaction there, and asked people to allow us to do this study with their loved ones.
Mm.
And what we discovered was something that I think people have sort of informally known for a long time, and that is that in our later years, really whether we have dementia or not, the music from our courting years is the music that has the most powerful effect. So that people who were to the point in the Alzheimer's process that they did not recognize their loved ones, they had no idea what year it was or where they were or why they were there or how they got there. They no cognitive awareness much to speak of. But when I would go to the piano and I would start playing Tiptoe Through the Tulip, or In the Good Old Summertime, or one of the favorite ones, not surprisingly, was My Old Kentucky Home. I mean, people would literally sit up and get a smile on their face, tap their toe, oftentimes sing along with the music. It was just, it was very dramatic, really.
Wow.
And the nurses would say, you know, so-and-so never smiles, never talks.
Huh.
And to see them sitting there singing with you is just amazing.
Wow.
So it's not a cure. It doesn't stop the progression, but it's what we call a quality of life intervention. And if for even 30 minutes, during the day, you can give a person some pleasure that they have not been able to experience in a long, long time. And especially if the family members are there with them and can appreciate seeing their mom or dad smiling and singing, and maybe for a brief period after the music, they might even talk a little bit, but they sleep better at night, they eat better at dinner, they're less combative, just all kinds of wonderful positive benefits.
Well, it sounds like just about anybody could do this with a loved one, like, you know, people who have loved ones in the hospital or, like you said, with Alzheimer's. But you would have to then select the music that would stimulate them.
Mm-hmm.
So it would require a little bit of thought.
Right.
But if it's chosen wisely, it sounds like it's a way of bridging the gap between this world and theirs.
Exactly.
Wow,
exactly.
That's pretty exciting.
It is. It's very exciting. And you know, that's the thing about most of the musical interventions that I use is they're very simple. You don't have to be a music therapist in order to do them. If people, I think people just tend to overlook music sometimes because it seems so easy.
Right, right.
You know, when you think, you know, well, now music isn't going to stop pain or, you know, bring a person out of depression. And oftentimes, you know, especially one session isn't going to do anything miraculous, but over a period of time, at the very least, it's a wonderful distractor.
Oh, yes, exactly. Yeah.
And one of the things I really want to emphasize is that whenever possible, if you or any of our listeners want to use music with someone who is ill or in the hospital or in pain or depressed, try to get live music if possible. You know, even if you just sit by someone's bed and sing some favorite songs with the person, you know, You Are My Sunshine, something that everybody knows, you know, Happy Birthday or a Christmas Carol or folk songs, whatever whatever that person loves, having live music is always better than just putting on a CD, or way better than turning on the radio. The radio is not a very good source for therapeutic music.
Oh, okay. Not even talk shows like this one?
Oh, well, of course, that's an exception.
Why, this will heal the world.
and this isn't music, primarily.
Well, yes.
But people are very self-conscious about singing in public, but I've done lots of workshops in hospitals around the country, and I do in-services for nurses and other healthcare professionals, and they've told me later that they very timidly started singing to some patients, or just singing with patients, or even humming, just sitting down beside someone's bed and taking their hand and humming Amazing Grace, which is one of the most requested songs in hospitals. That the benefits are just, it can make a person's blood pressure go down, you know, stop them from being as isolated and lonely. The benefits just go on and on.
Well, also, I was going to ask you what the point would be of having music during surgery, but you can answer that. It seems that people are often aware, even out of body, or have some kind of awareness of what's going on many different levels that we are now just beginning to explore. So, what do you think about music during surgery?
Well, that is one of my big soapboxes these days, is encouraging everyone who has advanced knowledge of surgery for either themselves or a family member or a loved one. The idea is, when the patient has music with headphones, the music that you want to use is purely instrumental music, no lyrics, because the lyrics engage the left brain and a person starts, you know, analyzing the music and thinking, who is that singer and do I like that song or not? If you have purely instrumental music that is a slow, steady beat, the same pulse as the resting, healthy heartbeat, studies have shown that the patient can take up to 50% less anesthesia.
Wow.
And that is a huge advantage, because one of the things you have to recover from after surgery is the anesthesia.
Yes.
So if you can get the same benefits with 50% less by using music through headphones, then that is definitely something you want to do.
Alice, what do you think about using things like the CDs? I have some that I use myself. I don't use them as regularly as I used to, but they are instrumental, and they bring you into various states like alpha, theta, and delta.
I think those are good. I think those are very good. And I think especially with, you know, pain management, those kinds of things can really be helpful in having people be less aware of the pain. It just causes every fiber, every muscle fiber to relax. But I think the thing during surgery is, I mean, you're not only keeping the, I don't think I said this, but what you're doing is the heart rate and the breathing are synchronizing or in training with the music, so the body stays more relaxed. And another benefit is that it's blocking out conversations that, when patients are lying there with nothing over their ears, they do wake up reporting that they heard the doctor saying, you know, oh, this doesn't look good, or, you know, I'll give them 2 months or something. Or even nurses and other people standing around talking about their date the night before, or what they want for lunch or something.
Yeah. They hear the whole conversation.
That's so terrible. The headphones, listening through the headphones, puts the music into the brain through the eighth cranial nerve.
Wow.
And not only do the heart and breathing synchronized with that music, but it blocks out extraneous conversations and bleeps and blips that they don't really need to be hearing anyway.
Yeah, that's a wonderful idea. You mentioned toning. I hear that used a lot. What is toning?
Toning is making sound, a vowel sound on the exhaled breath.
Okay.
And I have a good example of toning on my website, if we were going to mention that.
Oh, absolutely. I want you to.
Yes. Well, thank you. It's www.healingmusicenterprises.com.
Okay. Healingmusicenterprises.com.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And if you go to, Healing Music Tools.
Okay.
It has, well, and there are also media clips. That's where the toning is. There are media clips of television shows I've been on and radio shows, and one of them says Dr. Cash toning.
Oh, okay.
And so you can hear a good example of that.
Oh, good.
But also that's where I have, in the Healing Music Tools, tapes that I've created for surgery, and one of the tapes is talking about, it's an interview basically with me talking about how to let your surgeon and anesthesiologist know in advance that you want to bring in your Walkman or Discman or whatever.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because, you know, I am sure that most medical professionals don't really, they're not at a point yet where they're aware of alternative assist booths in the
exactly.
Trip. So you just have to approach them and let them know what you want.
Right, you really have to educate them.
Mm.
But, I mean, there is so much scientific documentation that it's hard to argue with it. But I do tell people, you know, give them as much advance notice as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Because I did have a lady the other day wait until she got to the hospital that morning for her surgery to let the doctor, the surgeon and anesthesiologist know, and they said no.
Oh.
Which is really a shame because more and more now, many surgeons and anesthesiologists have their own music with a boombox, you know, and I hear about doctors playing rock and roll and a lot of upbeat music to keep their own energy level up.
Uh-huh.
But what they don't realize is that's the very opposite of what the patient needs.
Oh, you'd think so, yeah.
So that's why if the patient has headphones, then the doctor can have his boombox, you know, over to the side or speakers on the wall or something like that playing their music that'll help them to stay focused.
Right. Well, I know they do use music now in dentistry a lot, and they put you into
dentistry kind of led the way.
Yeah.
They started using headphones back in the 50s to provide either music or white noise so that people didn't have to listen to that unnerving drill.
Yes.
Because that's one of the most painful sounds, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's something I'm curious about. What is the Mozart effect?
Okay, the Mozart effect popped into the news big time, I'd say, about 10 years ago.
Okay.
And it was based on a study that was done at the University of California, Irvine.
Okay.
With high school kids that were getting ready to take the SAT exams.
Okay.
And so they divided these kids into three groups, and one group listened to their favorite pop music, one group listened to nothing, and the third group listened to a specific piece by Mozart.
Okay.
It was a sonata in D major for two pianos.
Okay.
And time after time, the students that listened to the Mozart before they went into the test scored 9 to 10 points higher on verbal and math.
Wow.
And then Irvine did several other Mozart-related studies. But a man named Don Campbell, who was one of my friends and mentors, wrote a book called The Mozart Effect.
Oh.
And it came out in about 1997, I think. And as a matter of fact, he mentions me in that book and the surgery music ideas.
Oh.
And it became kind of a pop phenomenon, pop culture phenomenon, I would say. And Don, after the book came out, made loads of CDs, Mozart for babies and Mozart for this, Mozart for that. And somehow a marketer, I think, got a hold of this idea and twisted it a little bit to say that if you play Mozart for your babies and your children, that it'll raise their IQ. And the original research never said that. And so some people then came on pretty heavy about this is, you know, poo-pooing the whole idea and saying it's not real.
Uh-huh.
But the fact is, no one ever said that it would raise your IQ, your baby's IQ, or anybody else's. They just said that for test-taking, for activities in which you really need to focus, like balancing your checkbook, let's uh-huh. say, or working on your taxes,
uh-huh.
it's not a bad idea to put some Mozart on softly in the background.
Huh.
And a man named Dr. Alfred Tomatis, who was also one of my teachers, said the same thing is true of Gregorian chant.
Oh, yeah, those are wonderful.
And they really help you focus your mind on what you're doing if you put it on softly in the background.
Uh-huh. You mentioned babies and music earlier. How soon can an unborn child actually hear?
That's a great question. That is part of Dr. Tomatis' research. He he wrote a book called The Secret Life of the Unborn. And his research and others since then have pretty much documented that the infant ear is beginning, the unborn child's ear is beginning to function by the end of the first trimester.
Mm-hmm.
And to start with, they can hear their mother's heartbeat, their mother's circulation, blood circulating, and digestive noises.
Mm-hmm.
And then by early in the fourth, in the second trimester, the fourth month, they can begin to hear and recognize their mother's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the second trimester, the sixth month, they definitely can hear extra utero sounds, you know. In other words, whatever the mother hears, mm-hmm. pretty much the baby can hear.
Mm-hmm.
So I do a lecture about once a month at a local hospital for expectant parents, and one of the big things I encourage them to do is to start singing to the unborn child no later than the beginning of the second trimester.
Mm-hmm.
Because a study was done at UCLA, I believe, with parents who were taking part in the study. Each couple chose five different songs that they would sing every night to the unborn child.
Mm.
And at the time of birth, they had cameras right on the baby the second they were born.
Uh-huh.
And the parents would start singing some of these songs. And the babies, when their heads emerged, they would not be crying. They would be looking to try to find the source of these songs that were so familiar.
Wow.
And it showed that when you sing to your unborn child these same songs for probably a couple of years anyway, will calm them down and comfort them when they're crying.
Wow.
Just almost immediately.
That's amazing.
Isn't that wonderful?
It is.
I mean, it is just so fascinating and fantastic to have this information because, you know, I'm trying to write articles as fast as I can and put articles out there, and I do have an e-zine, and if you go to my site and sign up for my free e-zine, you can get all this information and a lot more.
Oh, great. So how do they sign up for that? Is it just on your site?
Well, when you go to www.healingmusicenterprises.com, the second that page opens, there's a little thing we call the fly-in.
Okay.
It's kind of like a pop-up, except it comes from the side.
Oh, yeah, I know those.
Yeah, and it says, you know, sign up for Dr. Cash's free e-zine, and you put your name, first name, and your email address, and from that point on, you get my e-zines and a lot of other mailings, like I let everybody know I was going to be on the radio show tonight.
Uh-huh.
And I've got about 2,000 people on my list now who get regular information about music and healing from me.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I encourage everybody to do that, by the way.
Thank you.
You know, this might be a little bit off topic, but, you know, it's said that the mothers are beginning to be able to communicate with their children prior to birth, and that they're actually speaking, you know, some kind of pre-contract. You know, they're actually having conversations about, you know, do you want to... can you be my mother? Will you be my mother? And the mother's mm-hmm. communicating with the spirit of the soul that's about to enter. So on levels that we may not be aware of, there might be communication that, you know, is also complementary to music.
Absolutely. Yeah, so choosing the songs that you sing very carefully because, you know, the messages definitely penetrate the consciousness,
I think. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
What's the best music that you've found consistently for just its overall healing qualities? Is there like chants, or would you, crystal bowls are really nice and things like that. What do you find in general tends to work the best? Is there anything?
Well, I think, you know, unfortunately, there's no one thing that I could say
right across
the board, you know, this is the best thing.
Right.
I think it is very dependent upon the person's age
and
the sort of music that they listen to and have listened to throughout their life up to that point.
Right.
Here in Kentucky, when I'm doing music therapy at a hospital or at my office or in a home, I have found that a lot of people like country music.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that was not something I was real familiar with, you know, because I was pretty much a classical musician.
Uh-huh.
And I love Bach and Mozart and Chopin and Paco Bell and Brahms and Tchaikovsky and Debussy.
Oh, yeah, they're all great.
But, you know, when people say, I want to hear Dolly Parton, you know, or Loretta Lynn singing such and such a song, you absolutely must honor that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it has behooved me since I stepped into this field in around 1990 to familiarize myself with all kinds of music. And it's been a wonderful thing because, you know, I guess I had a pretty narrow range of what I thought I wanted to listen to.
Right, right.
So, I mean, sometimes we're doing Broadway musicals, and sometimes we're doing Bach cantatas, and but generally speaking, this thing that I said a while ago about the Alzheimer's patients, the music from your courting years tends to be the music that's the most powerful. And, you know, like for me, I graduated in high school in 1966, and I was listening to Petula Clark and the Beatles and the Four Seasons and the Platters and all of that.
Oh, yeah.
And that music has powerful emotional connections. And I think, you know, when people are first falling in love, they have a lot of hormones coursing through their body.
Yeah.
And so the music that you listen to, you know, it creates a bond. You hear that music, you get a surge of those I'm in love hormones.
Right, right. And then the music is naturally associated with the neurological response.
Right.
Yeah. So the synapses are firing, and those pathways already exist to excite you.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes that sense. That's kind of similar to how addictions work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they function using the synapses. Have you had much experience with using music in addictions? I know this is a very difficult area to tread in.
Well, actually, I have. I've worked with quite a few people in a 12-step program, which I will not name for the sake of anonymity.
Right, right.
But I've been to national conventions probably 10 or 12 times, and I have done a lot of toning and chanting with people in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it is very powerful, especially in early recovery, when there's a lot of obsessing about using.
Right.
You know, the mind is thinking.
Oh, yes.
At every,
every
unpleasant experience, I need to go get my drug of choice.
Right.
You know, I just need to do my drug of choice or my behavior of choice or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have taught people how to just stop at that moment and start toning in a sitting position, in a lying down position, in a standing position. You just start taking deep breaths and making these long vowel sounds like, ah. And when you're doing that, literally your mind is totally focused on that tone.
Huh.
And I think in early recovery, the lie that so many people believe is, if I just do it, I'll get it over with and move on.
Uh-huh.
But the truth is, you don't have to do it. You don't have to use or act out in order to get beyond those feelings.
Mm-hmm.
You can stop and you can tone for a long time. Drumming can do the same effect. You know, sitting down with a drum for 5 or 10 minutes, a hand drum I think is best.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, you know, one of the hallmarks of the 12-step programs is the serenity prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So I have learned a chant that someone has turned the serenity prayer into kind of a chant.
Oh.
And I'll be glad to chant it for you if you want to hear it.
Sure, yes, go ahead.
Okay, it's pretty easy. It's just, God grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And you just keep doing it over and over.
Wow.
And, I mean, literally, you will go into an altered state pretty quickly.
Wow.
And if you're doing it with a group of people, like the hospital where I have worked in Louisville for a long time has a big chemical dependency program.
Uh-huh.
So once a week, I came in at their meditation, and we did toning and chanting and all of those kinds of things. Another big technique is to take all of the songs that are out there about drinking and using.
Uh-huh.
And you know, especially in country music, there are just all kind of songs about, you know, go out and get high or drunk or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And so we take those words and change them to recovery messages.
Oh.
You know, let's go out and go to a meeting.
Wow.
Or let's go out and talk with our sponsor, you know, or something like that. And, I mean, at first it may sound kind of hokey, but people really have fun doing that and getting creative. And, you know, I believe that addicts and alcoholics are very creative, intelligent, spiritual people.
Mm-hmm.
And once they click into that network, it's just the best years of their life from then on.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you know, I've begun to develop a theory that most people who are who are addicted to something are simply more sensitive, either empathic or psychically tuned in, or you know, and they just can't seem to take that kind of intensity of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, with the dysfunctional backgrounds we have as children, you know, I know for myself I was empathic as a child, and so, you know, but I had a couple of alcoholic parents, that didn't help any.
Right.
But I also think that we choose our parents.
I do, too. I mean, ever since I started reading Louise Hay, it just made so much sense to me. I thought, boy, but why did I choose the parents I chose? And when I look, you know, from a distance, a little bit, I know exactly why I did.
Yep.
So it's a wonderful awareness.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, when you're on the other side of it, you know, sufficiently to think clearly, you can begin to make those connections, and which can't be made when you're under the influence, unfortunately. So, when you mentioned drumming earlier, a lot of people up here where I live in the foothills drum, and people are beginning to find drumming a big thing going around the country. Why is drumming a real basic thing? Does it have to do with the heartbeat, or is it primitive?
Yes, that's part of it. I think, especially if people have trouble creating lasting relationships or bonding, or are very shy or socially anxious, that sitting in a circle of people with a drum where nobody has a lot of experience, but you just start beating on the drum, and before you know it, everybody is totally synchronized, and you start doing all kinds of different things that somehow you're in your own little world, even though you're in a group, and the self-consciousness goes out the window, and the power of the drum is really amazing. I mean, there are a lot of vibrations that you're putting into your body, and then there begins to be just this energetic bond between all the people who are there.
Yes.
And you can get out a lot of emotions. I did a little bit of drumming therapy this week with one of my child clients who's, I think, 11 years old. And I was asking her to make the drum sound, you know, angry, sad, happy, scared. And we spent, you know, I'd say at least the first 30 minutes having drum conversations about emotions. And a lot of times it's very hard for people to put into words what they're feeling. And especially children, you know, they're reluctant to criticize their parents because they don't know what the consequences might be.
Right.
But, you know, I can say, tell me with your drum how you feel when your father comes home from work.
Wow.
And, I mean, you know immediately, and yet you don't force the child to say something negative that makes them feel disloyal and possibly fearful.
Wow, that's really terrific. So it's a way of really allowing them to express themselves without having to say in words.
Exactly.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, I would never have thought of that.
Well, one of the most amazing cases of that was actually Don Campbell wrote about it in his book, The Mozart Effect.
Uh-huh.
A little girl that I saw, gosh, 10 or 15 years ago, she was about 10 years old, and she had been sexually molested by her stepfather or her mother's boyfriend, I think it was. And she was beginning to have a lot of rebellious acting out behavior. They brought her to me, and I found out that this little girl had a beautiful voice. So I had an instrument, still do, called a omnichord, and it's kind of like an auto harp. You know, you hold it in your lap, and you just kind of strum it.
Oh, yeah.
So when the little girl would come to her session, she did not want to talk about what had happened to her.
Uh-huh.
But when I would start strumming on the omnichord, she would suddenly start singing a song that was about what he did to her and how angry she was. And she would just sing like a country singer. I mean, she sounded like a little miniature Dolly Parton or something.
Wow.
And the second I would quit strumming on the omnichord, she would stop singing, and then she would refuse to talk about it, but
wow,
she would sing about it.
Well, you know, this is really opening some doors here. You know, I'm sure that it is for other people as well.
I hope so.
You know, if people are interested in this kind of thing, in getting into this field, what would you suggest?
Well, what I do is similar to what music therapists do. I mean, I'm sure music therapists do a wide variety of things,
mm-hmm,
but if someone is interested in this, that's like in high school or something, first of all, you need to have at least one instrument that you can play, improvise, you know, usually guitar, piano sometimes, occasionally a flute or a harp, a small harp, something like that.
Uh-huh.
So you need to be mastering some instrument, and then you need to be able to sing, you know, hundreds of songs just spontaneously. The more songs you know, the better,
mm-hmm,
because the more people you'll reach.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can actually major in music therapy in college.
Oh, wow.
If people are not sure that they want to major in music therapy, I would just encourage them to take as much psychology and music courses, and if possible, some anatomy and physiology.
And maybe a little art, too.
Yeah, yeah. But many colleges do have music therapy degrees nowadays.
Wow.
But as I said, I have bachelor's, master's in piano performance, and then a PhD in musicology.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back to school one more time and got a master's in clinical social work.
Wow.
So I've sort of created my own brand of what I call music medicine.
Uh-huh. That's
and
incredible.
Music healing.
One thing that I'm wondering about, I know there's music that really just makes me want to cringe, and I'm just going to say it, it's rap music.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something about rap music that is, you know, is there anything that I'm noticing about that, or is that just a matter of personal taste?
Well, I mean, I do think people tend to like the music of their generation, and rap music is pretty foreign to us, I think, because we had nothing like that, you know, back in the 60s or 70s.
Right, right.
But I think the thing that is scary about rap music, and this isn't all rap music, I have learned, I mean, nowadays there's even a thing called Christian rap
that's
talking about, you know, Christian values and stuff, but in that rap sort of rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that is dangerous about rap music is the what they call the gangster rap.
Right.
That is very violent, has very negative, violent lyrics, sometimes talking about, you know, let's go kill a cop or something like that.
Right.
And, again, studies have been done on this. Scientific studies have been done. And youth that are at risk anyway, they're coming from families that have very little love and caring about the young person, those kids are more set up to be negatively affected by rap music.
Mm-hmm.
And if they sit in a car for extended periods listening to these songs over and over and over and over,
mm-hmm.
then it's likely that they may act on those words and actually go out and do some of the things that they're hearing about in these songs.
Mm-hmm. The other music that I find always kind of puts me in a foul mood, or strikes me, not a foul mood, but it kind of strikes me in the wrong direction, is modern classical music that's chaotic. You know, the 21st century.
Yeah, I'm not crazy about that. And, you know, I think it's experimental music, and a lot of it is very cerebral, you know.
Yeah.
People are just trying all kinds of different things. I have trouble enjoying it at all.
Yeah.
I really do.
Well, I'm glad you said that, so I know it's not just me.
Well, no,
it's kind of
not
a reflection of the age we're in, you know, and we seem to be in some pretty chaotic times right now.
Right.
Do you work with any of the special kids? Have you noticed any of the autistic or indigos or crystals or what you would call, you know, the kids that are supposed to be of the higher vibrations?
You know, I have not really worked with any, as far as I know now. I have worked with some autistic children,
mm-hmm.
and there is a well-documented effect of music reaching children with autism when nothing else will. I mean, apparently,
mm-hmm.
I don't know an awful lot about it, but when children are diagnosed nowadays as early as 18 months with
mm-hmm.
autism,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, they
mm-hmm.
have very little speaking, and when their parents speak to them, they don't even look up, and
mm-hmm.
they don't want to be touched or hugged or anything like that. But when someone plays music, either comes in the room with a guitar or even a record or sometimes even songs on TV,
mm-hmm.
these children will stop what they're doing and look up and pay attention.
Mm.
And even when they don't talk to communicate their needs or they want, they will sing. You can sing things to them, and they'll pay attention, like, tell me your name,
huh.
you know, or how are you today,
uh-huh.
and they'll say, I am fine.
Wow.
So I've worked for about 6 months in a music therapy program for autistic kids, and
uh-huh.
all of these 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds just loved music and knew literally hundreds of songs already.
Really?
But if you wanted to sit down and have a conversation with them, you know, it wasn't going to happen. I'm not sure that people really understand what's going on there, but people who work with autistic children are well aware that music is a very powerful tool for reaching them and teaching them.
Uh-huh. Well, it sounds like it, you know, it definitely transcends any age or, you know, style or lifestyle or anything. What about near-death experiences or people who are transitioning into, crossing over to the other side? How far have they been actually able to hear as they go out?
Yes.
Anybody come back to talk about that?
Yes.
Oh.
Now, I'm so glad you asked me that, because that, again, is another very exciting but little-known phenomenon. Of the five senses,
uh-huh.
the sense of hearing is the first to develop and the last to go.
Oh.
So there is actually a program. There are probably several now, but the original one started maybe 20, 25 years ago in Missoula, Montana, at St. Patrick's Hospital.
Okay.
And it's called the Chalice of Repose Project. And it's based on a medieval concept and practice that, you know, was going on probably in the 1200s, 1300s. And when a person is transitioning to the other side, they have someone who is trained to play these small little Celtic harps,
mm-hmm.
and they sit at the bedside, or sometimes they will actually get in the bed with the person and play this harp and sing these beautiful Gregorian chants sometimes,
wow.
or melodies from the medieval period.
Wow.
I think probably more as it moves east to Appalachia, they might be singing some hymn tunes
uh-huh.
to them, you know, or whatever kind of music that is soft and comforting.
Mm-hmm.
And so they say, just as we have midwives that transition babies from pre-birth to life as we know it,
mm-hmm.
Then they're like midwives that are transitioning people at the end of life
mm-hmm.
to the other side. through music.
Wow.
Isn't that neat?
It is amazing. You know, I think that there's going to be a lot more focus on that kind of experience as we begin to connect with our, you know, with our higher selves and with our spirit and our soul and begin to have, you know, more experience with that area.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the physical and the metaphysical are beginning to merge.
Right. Right.
You know, and you mentioned about the harp. You know, I was in Mount Shasta last weekend and listened to a fellow named Eric Berglund.
Yes.
Do you know who that is?
Well, I think I heard a little bit of that.
Oh, he was just incredible. He played an Irish harp. And I haven't seen an angel live yet. But if there was such a thing, he would be it. And
uh-huh.
I mean, I was just floating, you know,
wow,
way out there somewhere. And so I know that music is very, very powerful. And on the way back, they played, you know, I was driving, it was dark and there was a full moon. And do you remember the old show, Music from the Hearts of Space?
Yes, I love it.
Well, I just randomly tuned it to my FM radio. I did the AM thing, and then I did the FM. Well, it came in clear as a bell, and for an hour and a half, I was just transported listening to this incredible music.
That's
so when
great.
I got home, I ordered some from, you know, some of the music that I like that I hadn't been in touch with. And I think there were some openings there at Mount Shasta.
Wow.
You know, so I think music is a wonderful tool. You know, and I'm looking forward to exploring it for myself a little bit more because I've dropped some of those tools.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I think we can put them back in our lives. You know,
absolutely, like, and especially if people are interested in pursuing toning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's you're healing yourself with your own voice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you can also heal other people with your voice, toning
mm-hmm.
for other people,
mm-hmm.
and you don't have to buy anything. I mean, all the instructions are on my website, plus
mm-hmm.
examples, and I have a tape, actually, called Toning and Chanting for Addiction Recovery.
Oh, good.
And that's available, I believe, now as a tape, a CD, or a download.
Oh, wonderful.
On my site.
Wonderful.
So I hope people will take advantage of that if they're interested, and, you know, you can email me anytime, and I'll be glad to answer any questions that anybody has.
At the website or?
Uh-huh, at the website.
Okay.
Yeah, there's just a contact button, and you just click on that, and it'll open up a little form, and you can send in your question, and you can also have a consultation, a 30-minute consultation or a 60-minute consultation.
Wonderful.
Talk about specific problems.
Do you have any favorite stories or anything that you'd like to share with us tonight about music that's warm your heart or amuse you?
Well, I have one that to me is pretty good, and it's got a big funny part to it, too.
Oh, good.
It's actually about my mother. She was having heart bypass surgery about 7 years ago, I think, 7 or 8 years ago. And when she told me she was going to have this, she lives in South Carolina, where I'm from. And I drove down from Kentucky, and I said, you know, I'll be right down, and I'm going to bring all my CDs and headphones. And she said, well, okay. She wasn't really thrilled about trying that. But she said she'd give it a try. So when I got down to South Carolina, I started playing all of these CDs that I recommend so that we could pick the very best one for her surgery.
Uh-huh.
And normally, I do recommend people listen to harp music, sometimes harp and flute,
uh-huh.
a simple arrangement of the Pachelbel canon, things
oh,
like
yeah.
that. Well, everything I played, she really didn't like. And, you know, I think she was upset and agitated anyway about this upcoming surgery.
Mm.
And finally she said, Alice, just play anything you want as long as it's not Nearer My God to Thee. So everybody got a big kick out of that. But what we finally chose was Handel's Water Music.
Oh, that's nice.
And so I talked to the surgeon, talked to the anesthesiologist, and she had about a three-hour surgery. So when it was over, the surgeon called my father and me back to the recovery area, and I expected her to just be, you know, conked out still
uh-huh.
from all the anesthesia. And as soon as we got within her eyesight, she just about sat up on the gurney or whatever it is she was on, And she said, "Oh, Alice, I love the music. Da dum bum 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 bum." You know, the Handel Water music.
Yeah.
And she said it was just beautiful.
Wow.
And I was flabbergasted because my mother is not a real gushy kind of person.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought, you know, maybe the music helped to remove some of the blockage that was in her heart, because she has just been a lot more upbeat and optimistic ever since that.
Wow.
And I really think the music had a powerful effect in that way. And now she says, you know, please tell everyone that you talk with to use music during their surgery. I would never have surgery without it.
Wow.
And she's had 2 hip replacements and a major hiatal hernia surgery.
Uh-huh.
And every time she's had music, and every time she's done beautifully.
Wow. Well,
I think, you know, it's definitely worth a try. It's not going to harm anything,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that
mm-hmm.
first rule of medicine is do no harm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's an easy, powerful, and yet harmless intervention.
Oh, absolutely. And I loved what you said about the Alzheimer's thing. That really struck a chord there.
Yeah.
You know, there's
and
so
with
many...
the unborn child, I mean,
there are
so many areas that music
yeah.
can be used with. Really, there's not any kind of physical, emotional, or life problem, I don't think, that music can't help.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Do you have any favorite music, by the way? What do you listen to?
Oh, I listen to a wide variety.
Yeah.
Recently, I've been listening to this beautiful CD by a local jazz musician named Harry Pickens.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a lot of the great love ballads done jazz piano style. I love that. I love Celtic music, you know, the Irish folk music.
Yeah.
I love classical music, of course. I mean, I play Chopin and Brahms and Mozart and Bach and Beethoven on the piano. I do some hymn arrangements because, as I said, my father was a minister.
Uh-huh.
And there are many hymns that are deeply rooted in my childhood and my growing up years that
mm-hmm.
I just love.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm trying to make my own arrangements of them. And, you know, it's healing for me, whether it is for anybody else, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I love more and more different kinds of, I love reggae and calypso. And
oh, yeah.
I love holiday music. I love
yeah.
Broadway musicals.
Yeah.
I love the pop music from the 60s that I listened to, and
yeah.
from the early 70s, you know, when I was getting married, I used to listen to all the Carpenter stuff.
Well, you know, I hadn't thought about it, but it's possible, if you believe in reincarnation, that we have lived in many different forms before, that, you know,
yes.
we may have a propensity to all kinds of different music.
Right,
you
right.
know, we might have been living in India in a previous life, or
right.
in Africa, or some other country where the indigenous music will just touch us,
mm-hmm.
and there's no explanation for it, and there doesn't need to be either.
That's right.
So, well, wonderful. Well, let us have your site again before we get, I think we're getting close to the end of the show.
Yes.
And just mention your site again. And
okay, it's www.healingmusicenterprises.com.
Great.
And also, people can just put my name, Alice Cash or Dr. Alice Cash, in mm. Google, and my website will come up that way, too.
Wonderful. Well, Alice, this has been a great interview.
Well, thank you for having me, Lance.
It's nice to meet you actually, you know, in person on the phone. I think everybody should do this, you know?
Oh, it's fun. I love it.
I really do. And I've always liked you. You're a wonderful person, but, you know, it's different to email and then to have a
right,
chat on
to hear a voice.
You know, exactly. Well, you're just fabulous, and I really love your work. And,
thank
you know, I think you're a pioneer in areas that, you know, need to be explored, and I really honor that.
Well,
and
I appreciate that. I think of myself as kind of a musical missionary.
Yeah, wonderful. I love that, you know. thank you so much, Alice,
well,
Dr.
thanks
Cash.
For having me, Lance.
And thank you all for listening tonight. This is Zany Mystic, and this was another wonderful Fireside Chat. And blessings to all.
Thank you. Good night.
All right. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.